Mr. Albert, I think you have to push star. Oh, it should be telling you.
Okay, got it. Star six.
Star six. Okay, great. Thank you. I can never remember the number. Okay. Mr. Albert, thank you for joining us. Do you have any sort of time constraints today on your testimony?
I do. I have to be on a ferry heading to this work, but it's I'd have to be done with this by 12:30.
Okay. Then maybe we should take your testimony now just to get that over with. Mr. DeVore, I know you have another witness you wanted to call. Do you have any objection to taking Mr. Elbert's testimony right now?
No objection. Thank you.
Okay. Any objection?
I appreciate it.
Any objection from any of the other parties? I'm not hearing anything. Mr.
No objection.
Okay. All right, Mr. Krall, then is it okay right now if we go ahead and take Mr. Elbert's testimony and then we'll go back and take the testimony of other witnesses?
That would be fine, thank you.
Okay, so what I'll do is I'll swear in Mr. Elbert, and then Mr. Krall, you can ask questions of your witness. The other parties can ask questions of him. I may have some follow-up questions, and then we can go ahead and let him go. All right, so Mr. Albert, I'm going to swear you in if you'll raise your right hand and let me know when you've done so.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear or affirm that the evidence you will give in this matter will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
Okay, and if you could please state and spell your first and last name for the record.
Sure, first name is Kenneth, that's K-E-N-N-E-T-H. And last name is Albert, which is E-L-B-E-R-T.
Okay. Mr. Krall, you can go ahead with questions for your witness. If you could start with just kind of establishing his background and expertise briefly, just so we get that on the record.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Albert, you are a professional engineer, correct?
Correct, in the state of Oregon.
I understand that your license is not current. I guess this isn't all that uncommon in private practice. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's a matter of every 2 years you have to take some coursework to get updated. And I sold my home, so I'm building my own place. Didn't need my license to be reactivated right away. And I got busy with other projects. But it doesn't preclude that you can do work. It just precludes that you can't stamp something until you get that taken care of. It's just a procedural thing.
So you just
think I've had that happen when I was in Africa volunteering and come back and, you know, the time expired and then I had to go through the process again. So it's fairly common in the private practice, not so much in the public sector.
Just kind of routine. I assume you've had to take that exam probably a couple times. How'd you do last time?
Oh, 300 questions. I missed part C on one question, so it's not a big deal. It's just a matter of getting to it, isn't it?
Okay, yeah, great. Thanks. So can you describe your education and experience for us?
Sure. I have a bachelor's in civil engineering, which entails a lot of hydraulics and structural engineering and geotechnical as well. And then I went out and got my master's at Oregon State University, which is basically revolves around concentration in hydraulic structural engineering, which basically involves river dynamics, creek dynamics, bioengineering, sediment transport, and debris, stuff like this. And it's more to do with the hydrology of the system, hydraulics, and taking into account landslides, stuff like that when you're designing facilities and so forth.
Okay. Great. Yeah. So can you give me an example of a project or where you considered and modeled landslide or debris flow effects on structures or other elements of the landscape?
Sure. One would be local would be Clackamas Cove down by Oregon City. There's a cove there, the Clackamas River. They run parallel together. There's a peninsula, and the Clackamas River is trying to chew through the peninsula to get into the cove. And so there had been been landslides here before, so we surveyed that extensively. We also did the bathymetry. For folks that don't know what bathymetry may not be, that's the topography under the water of the river, and that's done by sonar. Anyway, so we got all the information, put it together, and then I did the slow stability analysis on it. There's several areas in there that we did that on, that I did it on. And then we bioengineered it. Basically, it's a geogrid, a biotech wall with plants, and did rock toes, rib bedments, and also did some flow mitigation to keep the attack angle of the river away from the bank. And that's kind of it in a nutshell. That's one example, and there's other ones, you know, up at Olympia, Washington National Park. I worked on a restoration project up there that involved debris flows as well, and structural mitigation of the design that they did before because nobody could agree on it. And I'm just kind of a person that gets in the field and make things happen, and because of the experience of being out in the field. And another one would be Glacier National Park. I did the grand master plan for that for over 500, or actually 500 to the count, debris and water flow control structures. And that involved inventorying them all out in the field and GPSing them in, and then categorize them into what damage there is and some of the mitigation processes they can work on to get these things, you know, up to speed. Because they have a real problem with debris flow across their roads. And those are some examples from, you know, fish patches, culverts, you're dealing with debris and biomass movements all the time. So you have to take those in consideration.
Okay. So you have a lot of field experience, also a lot of ops experience in analyzing LIDAR and doing the calculations and modeling these flows. Yes?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So tell me, have you witnessed the debris flow events or their aftermath?
Oh, yeah, it's pretty exciting. I had a project up in the Olympic Peninsula I was just mentioning. I got through with finishing that project, and then we had 9-inch, 11-inch, and I think 13 inches the next day of rain, and all those in 3 days events. And so I got to watch this big, massive movement of flow and debris and large trees and rocks and everything else, and I got to see how the structure was that we put in assimilated and went with that, and it worked out well. It was really exciting to see that. And then you can see the aftermath of it. And in Glacier National Park, there's a lot of movement there, and every year they have to go through there and they get in with the dozers and the streams and restraighten things out. But you get to see a lot of the processes, and I think that's really where the caveat is of understanding these things, of being in the field and seeing them and witnessing them, working with them. And the firm I did have, I kind of retired for now, so I built a house, and that's what I had updated my license, but don't need it for a moment. But anyways, that's kind of lost my train of thought there. But that involved a lot of different... I just kind of lost my train of thought for some reason there.
That's not a problem. Long story short, you spend a lot of time in the field, and you understand the importance of both having a strong technical understanding of what's going on and being able to see things on LIDAR and see things remotely, but also the importance of boots on the ground.
Yeah, you know, LIDAR is really a handy tool. It's not an exact science, you know, but it's a very good tool, and you can get a lot of good information at that, which I'm sure that the geotech mentioned somewhere along this line. So it's, you know, it's another tool, and looking at it, you can make a lot of a good, you know, preliminary analysis of things, but getting in the field is where it's at when you start looking at the vegetation, like on this project, for instance, with the, you see new willows and stuff, and aspens, things like this, you know, there's kind of a current landslide. You can look at the rock features and know that it's a current landslide because of the, they're not rounded, you know, they're more square edged and stuff like this. And so that gives you a tool to get in there and see things. Yeah.
So the fine details, you got to see those on the ground, and that gives you the big picture and tells you what's going on. Okay, so...
And the vegetation line, yeah.
Okay, yeah, all of those clues. Can you describe, and getting back to the brief flow of events, you've seen these things happen, and you've seen their aftermath. Can you describe what an interaction between one of these events and someone's house might look like?
Sure. A good prime example up on the Columbia Gorge, I think it was 96, I believe. We had almost a big flood. And it's up there by, I think it's by Corbett. Anyway, gathered the landslide there and came down off the gorge, and you may all know or not, but there was a house there, a barn, and the whole house moved like 300 or 400 feet along with the barn, went downstream and towards the Columbia River, and the residents were still in there watching TV and what happened. But luckily they didn't die. But it did wreck the structure. It's abandoned now. And that particular event, I went up there right after because I'm really curious how these dynamics work. And I hiked all the way to the top of the gorge to see how it all came together and how it happened. It was just amazing to see these boulders go across the freeway there. But, so, yeah.
Yeah, that one shut down I-84. So you would agree with the Board of Forestry that debris flows are a significant public safety concern?
Yeah, they certainly can be, you know, depending on location of where, you know, structure or at or it happens, certainly.
Absolutely. Okay, so getting back to Tech Note 6, Tech Note 6 identifies the standard for substantial public safety risk as one death in 100,000 people, and as was discussed earlier by Mr. Buren, you know, that's a common public safety standard factors adopted, I think, from some civil engineering analysis work that was done in Australia, but it's been used elsewhere too. In particular, houses are called out for careful consideration in these analyses. So considering that standard, would you agree with me that this sets kind of a high bar? In other words, the board has chosen a cautious standard to avoid impacting homes at the base of steep slopes and canyons.
Oh, definitely. Using that number is super cautious, and that's, to me, that's more in line with like dam breaking and stuff, but nevertheless, that's the standard that they chose.
Right.
And so that, you know, makes it more important.
So it's a high bar.
Yeah.
So if you were analyzing a project or developing a structure or somehow otherwise engaged in work that would require a landslide hazard analysis in a basin like Spring Branch, which is about 100 acres, how much legwork would you expect to do in order to gather the information that you would need to do an adequate analysis to protect public safety?
Well, at first started out, I didn't get to hear the conversation that Mr. Byrne said, so it's probably some similarities to what he would do or has done. But I would start out with, you know, burials for one, and look where the structures at. I'd also look at LIDAR, and I'd look at the soil types. And there's, you know, Dagami has a lot of useful information and some historic data as well. And I'd also look at the morphology of different basins in the area that have the same issues, because you can learn an awful lot from that. And there's sometimes a lot of history behind that. Once you got those parameters down of basically the historic part that we have, which is a small glimpse because it's only maybe 100 years, but it's something you can run with. And then I would go to the field and start looking around, like I described earlier, about vegetation kind of anomalies that you can see where something has moved and has reestablished itself, and look for stream indicators like we're talking about with different kinds of forms of rocks and gravels, alluvial fans. I'd look at side slopes and adjacent basins to see if any of that material there actually contributes down into the region where the, like this particular case where the house is, which it looks like there may be some of that going on. Mm-hmm. And I'd also go up in the ravine itself and start looking for landslide information. You can do that. A lot of indicators are vegetation, you know, like trees slanting and what have you, and and soil movement. And you have to look at the soil type. There's all kinds of things. But as far as being out in the field, you know, it could be a couple days, it could be 3 or 4 days, you know, but and it depends how critical it is to do an analysis, depending on the structure, how in-depth you go, if you can go a long ways with it, or you can do more cursory.
Right. Of course, you don't want to waste time looking at something that there's not a safety concern. But that's the safety concerns. That's sort of one of the first things you want to vet, right? So before you even start your analysis, you don't see, well, is there really an issue here? You would want to understand, you know, what the fundamentals are. And it's sort of a building process. Is that what I'm understanding you to say?
Yeah, it's kind of a layered process, and sometimes you got to pick up and peek under a layer and see if that information is very good, and you got to correlate them together, because there's a lot of, you know, overlapping with things, and you know, it's not an exact science by any means, but a lot of it's to do with judgment and experience, and you know, trying to meet that standard is a pretty tough cookie, and
So you would expect to spend a lot of time in the field in order to make the best professional judgment, because that's the foundation of your analysis.
Yeah. That's what I would do, but after all the other data that we have, yeah. And I would also, again, I'd look on, you know, look up and downstream of different systems there to see, you know, different canyons and what have you, to see what they've done, so you can get a lot of information gleaning from that.
Yeah, that's a great point. So, I mean, there's probably no better evidence that we could possibly ask for than the behavior of these same slides. So we're looking at this one basin in isolation. Are you suggesting that looking at other basins would provide you a basis for making a reasoned estimate of what might happen in this basin?
Certainly, especially if it's the same range and the slopes are similar, vegetation is similar. I mean, that's, you know, it's kind of common sense.
Okay, I agree. So let me get down to some specifics here, and I'm sorry that you're not able to see, but I know you've seen the LIDAR that we've been looking at this morning, the LIDAR that shows Spring Branch Basin, and it shows the downstream houses and all of that. I don't know if you're able to see that in your phone to follow along, but you've already looked at this and you kind of know what's there. I just thought I would tick through a couple of elements, some of which are called out specifically in the guidance and some of which are at least suggested, or they would be common sense things. So one of the things that Mr. Buren testified to was the linearity of this particular basin. Are you able to see that on your phone right now? Like, can you get the LIDAR up on your screen?
Might be able to if I don't hang up.
I do remember
pretty well though. It's actually pretty interesting. Let me see if I can get that.
Yeah, take your time. I think it's important that you be able to see that. But if not, we can talk through it.
I got it right here.
Okay, so what I was thinking we might do is just sort of tick through some things that have been identified in the guidance, or that would be, you know, and perhaps you've got some other ideas about concepts. And again, we're talking about public safety here, right? So we're talking about people who are in harm's way. We're talking about members of the public who might die as a result of, you know, are missing important information. So feel free to add other things if you think of them. But so one of the elements is the linearity of the system. And Mr. Buren testified, the junction angles tend to slow down or stop a debris movement. But what about the linearity of this overall system? Would you say that it's a fairly linear system?
Okay, hold on just 1 second. Is that Mr. Denley talking?
It is.
Okay, go ahead.
So my objection is, as to Mr. Ebert's testimony, is essentially the same as my objection, as Bighorn's objection to kind of the expansion of the issues adhering to what I think is probably going to be Area D as described in Exhibit A6. And so to the extent that Mr. Ebert is testifying about those kinds of issues, Bighorn objects as irrelevant and immaterial to the issues raised and that have to be decided by the judge.
Okay, Mr. DeVore, do you want to add in at all?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, I support the objection and would get back to the point that we need to be looking at the Stewardship Forester's comments related to protection of the riparian zone.
Okay, Mr. Krall, do you want to respond?
Mr. Albert, could you describe the impacts of the debris torrent on the riparian management area that's at issue here?
Okay. So hold on just one second. So are you saying, Mr. Krall, then that you're going to rephrase your question?
I apologize.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. So just for the...
I'm trying to go back to questioning to answer your question, so...
No, that's okay.
Yes, I disagree with this objection because, again, everything is connected. And so the potential of this ground to generate slides, which has already been acknowledged by Mr. Buren, those events are enormous, catastrophic events. They are going to travel directly through the riparian management area that we're talking about. So there's no doubt that anything that the state forester is commenting on has to recognize this, the most powerful geologic force that shapes this entire system. I think it has to be
done. Okay. So for the record, we're all looking at Exhibit A6. Mr. Krall, I'm going to let you go ahead and rephrase that question and ask it again. Mr. Denley, I'm going to assume that your objection is a standing objection to this, so you don't need to object if the next question kind of brings up the same issues. They're noted for the record. And Mr. Krall, I'm going to let you ask these questions, but I want to make sure that we try and keep it kind of really focused on what we talked about at the last hearing. So go ahead whenever you're ready.
Okay, thank you. So the riparian management area that we're talking about, Ken, you can see on the LIDAR, would be in the northeast corner, sort of at the downstream extent of Spring Branch. So are you with me on the image?
Yeah, that's before it gets to the fan, basically.
Yes, well above that. It's within the boundary. So within that riparian management area, so basically... So within that riparian management area that's inside of the purple boundary, can you identify, based on this image, that there are steep slopes within that riparian management area?
Oh, certainly, yeah.
And then the
thing walked up there before, too. Yeah.
And that was actually with the state forester, with Mr. Cafferata and Mr. Jacobs, correct? On that field trip when
yeah.
we walked up. Okay.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So. There are steep slopes in the riparian management area itself, and those could have an effect, just like any other steep area. Well, I mean, you tell me, what's the impact of those steep slopes potentially as a result of logging and yarding?
Well, I mean, there's several things going on. I mean, I'm going to kind of summarize a little bit here. You know, I mean. If you can bear with me a minute here, we all know about the hydraulic cycle, right? And the hydrology cycle. There's hydrology to hydraulics, and just to be clear, hydrology is the rain, precipitation, all that kind of stuff. And the hydraulics is actually the actual physical movement of the water, what it does. So those are the two differences. I'm only saying this because I don't know who the audience is. So anyway, on the hydrology cycle. You know, you got precipitation, you got groundwater flow, you got plants that give up, and evapotranspiration, you know, through the leaves and what have you. And you got evaporation and snow melt, all kinds of things going on there. And when you do, and don't get me wrong, I'm not against logging. I think logging is a wonderful thing. It's renewable. And it's just a matter of managing it correctly. And in this case, we're talking about a house structure down here, so that's, you know, another important
the house structure. That's the key piece. I want to make sure that we stay focused on, because we're really talking about state here.
But what I'm getting at to answer your slope question is, when you log something, a lot of times this gets forgotten about the hydraulic cycle. Is you take away the trees, you just lost that source of evapotranspiration, which also unloads the water from the soil, so you get less amount of geological slope stability. I mean, it's stronger, basically, what I'm trying to say. And the other thing is, you got the root structure. I realize the Douglas fir, they're not like huge tap roots going way down. You know, most of the time there's moisture, they're kind of more surface-like. I understand that as well. But there's still that component you lose, and there's also the really important component that always seems to be forgotten about is acidic conditions. What's the condition that's happening when a big storm event comes? Meaning, is that ground already wet? Is the trees already wet? You know, if they're not, then those trees provide a way to relieve that pressure off the system. So, especially when you log closely to the stream, that affects the mass balance of this slope stability, and it also causes problems with, you know, the hydraulic cycle as far as of making this happen. It's kind of hard to say in a fast way, but basically when you're logging really close to the stream, it can cause a lot of problems just because of the dynamics of the way the system is and the balance of the system. And above that, you know, it's fine once you're out of it. As Bruin would probably know about the Coulomb theory of slope stability, and once you're out of that transition zone, you know, you're pretty good to go, really. But you have to consider that when you're looking at these things, in my opinion.
The focus on downslope station, and I completely agree. It's a very complex resource, and it deserves time, I guess is what you're saying. It deserves time and consideration. I think one of the really important element of this judgment, if you'll allow me to ask a question or to propose a concept we're here, which I think is fairly clear, but I just want to make sure that we've got it on the table. We're talking about a plan for alternate practice that is itself a standalone forest practice. It's afforded all of the same considerations that any other forest practice is, including a 623 review. So again, that's the basis, I think, for this. In addition to the fact that all of these resources are interconnected, I'm just wanting to provide that recommendation of the judge for consideration, if that's okay. I apologize, I'm probably getting out of sync here.
Okay, so that was that a question for your witness, or just something you wanted to bring up?
I apologize. This is actually in response to the objections that were raised and are continuing to be raised by the other counsels.
Okay. All right. Well, let's stick with your questions for your witness. Let's get through that, because at this point I've allowed you to, you know, kind of a little bit of leeway to go down that line of questioning.
Okay.
So do you have any more questions for your witness, or are you wrapped up there?
I do. I have a few more. I'll try to make it brief.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Robert, I just want to quickly kind of tick through a couple of things that I think have come up. They're either in the guidance, or they're things that you and I have talked about, or things that are just common sense with regard to slope stability and downslope safety. So if we're looking at the performance of this particular basin, I'm just going to give you a concept, and I want you to tell me if you think this would indicate a concern, a heightened concern, or perhaps less concern. So in terms of the linearity of the system, and try to keep it as focused as you can, the linearity of this system, would you consider this to be a relatively linear system? In other words, are things going to tend to bind up in this drainage, or are they going to tend to flow out on the main stem?
On the main stem?
Yeah.
Well, it depends where you are in the stem. I mean, on the slope, on the very beginning of where it's steep, you know, it is, to me, it'd be linear. It would tend to flow out, but as you start coming down, say midway, like where that purple line on the LIDAR is,
mm-hmm.
somewhere around there, the slope mm-hmm. kind of changed, and that, I think it might be, I mean, I'm in the wrong spot where those alders are, I think it's a little further downstream.
But anyways, when it starts to get in those areas, it'll start binding up, in my opinion. Uh-huh. And particularly if there's large woody debris.
Okay.
It's kind of like throwing out a bunch of toothpicks and they get all lined up.
Okay. So you're raising the issue of the function of large wood in this system, which is another kind of conversation. But it's obviously critically important to this issue of how we view this the proposed treatment. So linearity. So you might see something binding up there under certain circumstances. What if it didn't? If it were really moving through there, what's next? Where's it going?
Well, you're going to start getting sediment and biomass turbulence. You're going to start, basically landsliding again. I don't know, maybe not necessarily landsliding, but debris flow.
Okay.
And, it can, in a lot of, it's kind of like they talked about once about Utah, I'm not going to go into it, but basically you get a certain amount of debris in there, it starts piling up behind it, it's kind of making a small dam. And in the meantime, it's piling up and there's flow going underneath as well. And then, boom, that dam breaks, it goes down and it creates another one, it kind of pulsates. And I mean, it's really, really complex, and it can actually jump over the first dam and create another one, and then pretty soon the one in the back breaks and, keeps cascading. So it all depends on all the dynamics we've talked about. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're talking about a really catastrophic event, right?
Yes, just like the alluvial bands down there, how they happened.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and that is what we're talking about, right? If we're thinking about a standard of one death in 100,000 exposures, we're talking about the catastrophic events, right? Not the average event. It's really got to be considering the catastrophic events. Am I right?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Looking at this basin just very, very generally, is there a lot of energy in this basin?
There's a lot of potential energy, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
But a lot of that potential energy has to do with how much flow there's going to be as far as going downstream. Mm-hmm.
Okay. We have shallow soils in this, based on what you've seen and what you know of this part of the Coast Range and what you've seen, shallow soils, I think that's been acknowledged. But you would agree?
Yeah, as far as I know, I haven't done any core samples, but it sure is that way.
Yeah, it does look that way. In terms of analyzing, and we talked earlier about looking at adjacent basins, but sometimes there's good evidence in the basin itself that we can look at in the past to try to identify what the risk might be going forward. And you and I were looking at this LIDAR yesterday and looked at debris bands. Can you describe what you see here at the base of this canyon by way of debris bands?
Yeah, look, that's the caveat of this whole thing to me anyway. The analysis that Mr. Byrne did, I have to say, he writes really well. I like the way he presented his material. The one in 100,000, criteria, as he described in this brief part, there's really not a set exact way to do it. It's something that's kind of happened through processes and it's not an exact science, but nonetheless that's the standard. And when it comes to this home, which is I think home 7 on this LIDAR, that's a considerable location to really consider. And when you look at this this delta, this fan, you can see it. I think you pointed out once, kind of looks like a bear claw in a way. Anyway,
right.
So when you first look at it, it looks like a depression, but it's not. It's actually, it comes up, it's higher. And if you look at the topography, which is the purple lines, which this particular one doesn't have, the last one did, you can see that it's higher around there. So what that means is when
let me interrupt you real quick, Ken. I want to make sure everybody understands what we're talking about. So in the image here that's up on the screen, home 6 is at the top of this large fan feature that Mr. Elbert's describing. And it, like he says, it looks like a bear claw. And it's one of the optical illusions that happens with LIDAR. Sometimes things look like depressions when they're actually mounds. And this is a mound.
Okay, so Mr. Kroll, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but right now you're testifying. Means you're trying to provide evidence to me to look at. And right now you haven't been sworn in. Your witness is testifying. So I need you to just ask questions of your witness and let him answer. I think pointing out on the map where we may be looking is fine, but I can't have you at this point going into explanations.
I understand. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to deal with the limitations of the media that we have to work with through. So I just want to make sure that everybody understands where we're talking and how to see this, because that is important. But thank you. I'll try to be mindful.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Kroll. Go ahead.
All right. Judge, are you able to see the feature that we're talking about?
Yes. I see right near home six there. It does look quite a bit like a bear claw.
Okay. Great. All right. All right, thanks. So can you tell me, what does that feature tell you?
Well, one, there was a large event, you know, I mean, I don't know when that was, but, could have been a long time ago, but the thing about it, what it does tell you is that when in regard to home seven, the creek coming down there goes by home seven. On the lighter that I have, it's cut off, but it does continue basically north. West, northeast, or so, past the home. So that's the natural way the creek is flowing down. So if you get a debris flow coming down, or a landslide, or whatever, if it's a big event, because of this bear claw, so to speak, this rise, it's going to force, in my opinion, it's going to force it to the left, which is west, and towards the house seven. And it, you know, if it was a depression, it'd be a different thing, but it's not. And so that kind of acts like a revetment, basically, to push the flow towards the house. And that's my concern. That's also in the same area where the water structure is for his drinking water, and it's just going to do nothing but keep flowing through there. And if there is an event, it's going to, obviously take that out. But that van is putting up on where the debris flow is going to go. They're not going to likely go over top. They're going to go to the west because it's lower. So
that's a great point. What would you, speaking of drinking water, what would you anticipate the effect of such an event being on drinking water? That's actually one of the core issues here.
Yeah, well, I mean, that'll be taken out for sure, and they might be able to reestablish it at some point, but as far as being able to survive that, I don't think that's really possible.
Okay, great. I'm ready to wrap up this piece of it, but a couple other things I just wanted to touch base with. And so you've been to the site, and one other element that occurred to me, and I think you mentioned it earlier in our conversations, how do you describe the position of the structure on home seven relative to the surroundings? I mean, is it elevated, or is it set in or depressed in the landscape?
I'm trying to recall that. It might be elevated a little bit, maybe a couple feet, 3 feet, I don't remember for sure, but I know it's really close to the stream. And if there is a large event, it's just right there for the pickings.
I'll remind you, I know it's been a while and you've only seen the site once and we were really focused on the screen, but the structure is actually, it has a daylight base, it's daylighted
So Mr. Kroll, again, I can't have you testifying about how the house may be located. You can tell me about that during your testimony.
I understand. If the house were daylighted, would you be concerned? Would that raise your concern or make it less?
Can you repeat that?
Well, yeah, okay.
In terms of potential damage, what's worse, to have the house elevated or have the house recessed into the south?
Well, recessed is more apt to have consequences, even though it's concrete and stronger, but usually daylight basements have, windows and what have you, sliding glass doors and stuff. but that's going to destroy the integrity of the foundation. And once you do the foundation, you know, the house is toast. So.
Okay. Okay. Good. All right. That's what
I wondered. Either one of them doesn't really matter. It's either one of them not going to be a pretty story.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Great. So, you mentioned this before, but I wanted to highlight it a little bit, or just and make sure that I understood you correctly. How do you feel about logging in wood products?
Oh, I think it's an awesome thing. I mean, it's renewable. It's in fact, I'm starting a wood shop, you know, it's great. And I love the science behind it. It's just that, you know, we need to manage it better, in my opinion. And, you know, like, I don't like the idea of the phrase of how we kind of discount our forestry, you know, we're going down in years in the way we're logging and harvesting smaller, younger trees, but waiting longer. But it's a beautiful park. I'm not against it at all, believe me, but it just needs to be managed better.
Okay. All right.
Yep.
So I want to get back to the role of down wood in these systems. So the state foresters' comments on the written plan states, so I'm just going to quote from the written plan, if that's okay.
Sure.
Removal of trees within the riparian management area and stream channel of the impacted riparian management area would meet Geotech's recommendation to mitigate wood loading that is currently capable of being captured in a debris torrent event that could create destructive risks to the RMA and downstream areas downstream. So basically, what sort of analysis do you think is called for when we're talking about the down wood and its function here? I mean, is that a proposal that would require some consideration and analysis of its own right?
Well, again, it depends on what's downstream. I mean, in this case, with the house being the way where it's at, located, and the fan making things want to push towards the house, you know, I think that's the consideration. And whether you could actually do that's another question, because it's very complex. And trying to come up with a solution to that, it could be difficult. But
you would want to spend some time considering.
Oh yeah, I certainly want to spend some time considering about it and look at the geography there and especially the topography and vegetation lines and see what the potential is of this doing that. And that all comes with judgment, really. Obviously.
Yeah, I agree. Can you imagine mitigation measures? So let's assume that this logging project continues and all the logs get pulled out of the upslope areas and also out of the stream or riparian area. That leaves a certain circumstance on the ground that would be an eventuality. Can you imagine mitigation measures that might be effective in reducing downstream risks, given that this site's already completely logged?
There's a potential of with that fan we were talking about, the alluvial fan, basically redirecting that channel towards this center of the fan, but not I'm not saying redirect the creek, I'm saying creating a void there to where it has basically relief when a big event does happen and there's debris floats coming down, that besides the creek itself, there's this other area where that debris can go. And that's why that fan there is there in the first place, and that's why there's that ridge on the fans, because that's the way it wanted to go. And if you basically dig that out, then it's going to want to go there again, and that's one thing you can do. You can also put some log embedments or diversion dams in there to help with that. And the last thing I'd say you could do, which is hard to do because, it's upstream, you can't really get equipment in there easily, but you can do check dams, try to keep some of that sediment and stuff in there to slow down the velocity so things actually get trapped in there and trees start growing again to make it more stable. You know, so things like that you can do.
Well, what I know, your head's already turning on a bunch of different ideas, but the answer is you can imagine the mitigation measures.
Yeah, I can.
That's great. Mr. Elbert, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me. I have no further questions. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
You got to hang in there.
Yeah, so Mr.
Sure.
All right, Mr. Kroll, thanks. Okay, so let's move on to Cross. Unfortunately, my computer let me know a few minutes ago that it's going to restart in 15 minutes, and there's no way I can stop it, unfortunately, with our system. So if we can't wrap this up in 15 minutes, I might have to log off for a bit, and my sincere apologies. I think you should all remain in the conference if that happens, and I'll just rejoin, but I want to let everybody know. Okay, Mr. DeVore, let's start with your cross. Do you have any questions for this witness?
I do, Your Honor. And if Mr. Elbert needs to sign off at 12:30, what I would propose is if we could take a 5 or 10 minute break now, allow you to restart your computer, and then we could jump back on and have a full stretch until 12:30.
Okay. I'm fine with that. Does anybody have a problem if we take like 5 minutes and then we can keep going to 12:30 to get Mr. Elbert off on time?
It's fine.
Okay. So when I log off, it should keep you all in this conference. If for any reason it doesn't, you're going to have to log back in using that same link. I really apologize for this. But let's see, it's about 11:30, so let's take a 5 minute. 11:35, we'll come back. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
All right, this is ALJ Triana. We're back. It's 11:35. See, everybody's rejoining us. We have Mr. DeVore, Mr. Denley, Mr. Jacobs, Mr. Burren. I see Stimson Lumber's back with us. Mr. Kroll. All right. Looks like everybody we need is back. So let's go ahead and continue. Let's see. When we left off, Mr. DeVore, you were going to ask questions of Mr. Elbert. So go ahead whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Elbert, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, great. So my name is Matt DeVore. I am representing the Department of Forestry in this matter. Thank you for being available to testify. I did have a couple of questions and a couple of lines of questions that I wanted to follow up on. One of the points that you testified to was that as a professional engineer conducting this analysis, it requires an exercise of professional judgment to a certain degree. Is that right?
That's true.
And would you also agree that there are a wide variety of methods or tools that would be available to help render that judgment?
As long as they're not called out for, like in some code or something, I'd say that's great.
Okay. And in particular, in this instance, where there are Forest Practices Act and Department of Forestry rules, would you agree that the range of options is going to be more focused on what is prescribed by statute and rule? Would you agree with that?
You know, I'd really have to pore over that to, I haven't dug into this as far as statutes and rules, but off the top of my head, I would think that'd be correct.
If we were to look at an analysis of slope stability in regards mm-hmm. to the Forest Practices Act, you would agree that we need to look at what the Forest Practices Act requires, right?
Yeah, you'd have to look at that. Uh-huh. But it doesn't mean you might not disagree with it.
Sure. Well, and that gets to the point that I was making, that when you're exercising mm-hmm. professional judgment, you as a professional engineer and another professional engineer may have similar backgrounds, experiences, and education, but come to a different conclusion in exercising your professional judgment, right?
Certainly, and that's where, you know, the debate comes in of having these kind of conversations, because sometimes things just get overlooked, you know, or it's just the fact you look at that alluvial van looking like a depression instead of the, you know, higher up ground. So sometimes things like that get missed, and it's just, you know, it's nobody's fault. It just happens. So anyway.
Okay. Are you familiar with the Forest Practices Act, and in particular the Department of Forestry Division 623 rules for high landslide hazard locations?
I haven't had to deal with that particular rule before, but it doesn't preclude me from knowing, you know, the analysis that needs to be done to go to come up with these conclusions.
Well, if the analysis that needs to be done is stated in the rules, wouldn't it be important to know what those rules are before you start the analysis?
Well, yeah, certainly. But what I'm saying is that there's still this judgment factor, and you know, if the rules say you got to do it this way, that way, then you're kind of stuck with it. But if the rules just in generality tell you that, you know, it needs to be done like that 1 in 100,000, you know, figure of cautious, I mean, that's super cautious. And so how do you go about that? Without even reading the rules, I'm sure there's not a perfect way of laying it out, but they lay it out to you to get to that number. You know, I think probably Mr. Burnham probably talked to that effect as well.
Regarding that 1 to 100,000, can you tell us your understanding of how that standard is incorporated into the rules?
Well, as Mr. Murren said, he doesn't exactly know where that came from either, but I believe that's what he said. But I think that standard came from probably dam building standards, and it got adapted somehow. I don't know for sure, but that sounds like a number that would be used for that. And I've done some small dams, not big dams, but so you gotta have to watch out for those things. But as far as a clear path to get there, it may not tell you how to do that, but it probably doesn't.
My question was more focused on the Division 623 rules and how that standard is incorporated into the rules, if you know. And if you don't know, I understand that.
No, I don't know.
Okay. And then we've also talked about Tech Notes 2 and Tech Notes 6 of the Department of Forestry that interpret Division 623. Are you familiar with those Tech Notes?
Not to the degree that you all are, I'm sure.
Have you read them?
I've glanced through them. But as far as being able to, what we're talking about here, you know, rules or not, you know, what's the outcome of the circumstances that are here, you know, again, it's just a matter of how you go about coming out with that final decision of what needs to be done. But no, I haven't read them in detail.
Okay. What, you talked through some of your experience in Glacier National mm-hmm. Park and Olympia National Park mm-hmm. and
yeah.
the other one in Oregon on Clackamas Cove. Do you have any experience in Oregon helping with an analysis of a timber harvest operation applying the Department of Forestry Forest Practices Act?
Let's see. In Oregon. I'm trying to remember. I did some coast stuff. That was water resource.
experience in providing an analysis of a timber operation in Oregon under state law?
No, no, I have not.
Okay.
Not in that realm of what you presented to me. But those analysis get, I've done those, but not in the realm of formative logging.
You've done slope stability analysis, but not for logging operations?
Yes. Correct.
Okay. You mentioned that you had done a site visit. How much time have you spent at this, Mr. Lund's house or the Spring Branch?
How long were they? I think probably 2-3 hours, something like that. Wasn't real long.
Just on the one day?
Yeah.
There was some discussion about the downed logs, and you said that the downed logs could work like, I think you described it or analogized it, the toothpicks that could help to bind up the flow and slow down the flow. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that can happen. You know, it could also be logged out, you know, but I'm just saying that there's a good opportunity there for that to become a way to hold some of the debris back that is going to come downstream at some point. I don't think they're going to float downstream in a linear fashion and bat ramp stuff, but anyway.
What do you mean by bat ramp?
Oh, I'm just saying. Yeah, I don't know. People sometimes think that logs just kind of float straight downstream and, you know, slide along and hit things. And I mean, just in a linear fashion because it's in that constricted confinement area. You know, in a confinement area where it's narrow like that, to me, from what I've seen in the field experience that I had, they get all tangled up and woody debris matter and logs and everything. And basically, like I said, it's toothpicks. But, like dropping the toothpicks on the ground, they get all tangled up. Sediment gets in there, rocks in here, and then the trees start growing back in it. You know, and you see that all the time, particularly up in Washington, in the Olympic Peninsula areas. But, anyway, I don't know if that answered your question, but.
Would you agree that there are a lot of variabilities and it's hard to predict exactly how those downed trees would respond to a debris flow?
There is a lot of variability, and again, that comes down to judgment, but when you make judgments, you also have to consider that judgment is wrong, what's going to happen on the next downstream of that. Basically, if that doesn't plug up with debris and stuff, then the logs are going to move downstream a little more, and they might go somewhere else. And so you have to have a lot of things on the plate, kind of looking at different scenarios that's going to happen if something else doesn't happen. And that's the same way when I design things. I always leave what I call the Don Elmo effect, to where you have certain structures in the stream, and you put quite a few different ones in, and you let Mother Nature choose what it's going to do. But you do have some control over it. You just don't have the ultimate say in it. And by giving different Don Elmo effects for nature to choose, then it's gonna find a path and make it good. But but it is complex, and you can't actually predict it, just like you can't actually predict every, you know, slope stability. You can't exactly predict that either, but you do have these parameters that you, and experience that you work with to come up with those scenarios. Those, it's judgment again.
Yeah. Would you agree that one of the possibilities is that those logs could be set parallel to the course of the river and actually act as a bank to facilitate a flow?
In my professional opinion, I know that some of them are laying there parallel, some are crossed over just from falling, you know. But I think overall they are going to start binding up. I don't think they're going to lay parallel. I mean, there'll be a few that will, but they're going to move. And when they start hitting other vegetation that's in there, they're going to start to, you know, not be in a linear trajectory parallel with the stream. They're going to start going sideways and what have you.
And do you have any experience with trying to do reforestation in an area that has downed trees?
Yeah, I used a tree plant. I did that for a number, probably about year and a half down in Forks, Washington. That was a lot of fun.
And would you agree that it's going to, you would agree that it's easier to plant trees when you don't have downed trees, or not only easier to plant trees, but more likely to get a reforestation to stick if you're not planting them within downed trees in a riparian area?
No, I mean, it might be easier because you walk around easier, but doesn't mean they're going to grow any different. I really think that the more biomass there is and the more ecological pockets you got of different plants and stuff growing, you know, like there's a shade on the tree on the other side of Sunny and things like this, I think it's better and stronger for the forest to be growing with a little bit of mix. And I know when we were planting at Forks, Washington, and you know, it rains a lot. It rains like almost 200 inches a year. And when we're planting those trees, every step you take, you're slipping about a foot and a half. You're moving the bank. You're moving the soil because it's been cut and on those steep banks. And so you're trying to plant it, but the soil's moving on you. And so I think some stability, some biomass there is very helpful. Mm-hmm. So I would not agree that it's better to be voided of the logs to make tree planting possible, but it is easier because you can walk around.
Did Mr. Carl retain you for your testimony today?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, pay a contract or a fee?
We really haven't discussed that, but yes, I believe so. I mean, I volunteer my time for a lot of things, and that's, you know, right now, I believe it's on the retainment, yes. I hate to sound vague, but it's just, I believe in a lot of good things, and I love the wood industry, I really do. I like to see our mills do well. You know, it's just it's a great resource, and you know, in this particular case, in my view, we're talking about this house, the safety of the house, and you know, I just like to see that be out in the forefront and try to do the best we can and seeing that that's going to come through.
Had you known Mr. Crawl or Larry Lund? How long have you known them?
Larry Lund, I've only met him I think once or twice. But I've known George for a long time, and he's a really good forester.
Mm-hmm. How did you first meet Mr. Crawl?
We met at a city of Portland. We were there briefly. I was in one department, he was in another. We just crossed paths, and we hit it off as far as the systems we're dealing with. You know, I'm in water resources, and he's in forestry, and there's a lot of commonality there, so we started working together on projects, including wetlands and what have you.
Okay. So it met through your work and professional capacity?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you, Mr. Crawl asked about your professional license. So currently your license status is in a delinquent status, is that right?
They call it inactive, I believe, unless they change the language. But it's like I said, it's just a matter of taking this, what do you call those, the PhD credits or whatever it's called, and then you just take a little exam, and then you're reinstated, and you got to pay a fee. And you got to do that every 2 years.
When you're in this delinquent or inactive status, are you able to work as a professional engineer?
You can. The only thing you can't do is stamp the final product. And in this case, what we're talking about here, nothing for me to stamp, so it doesn't really matter. It's kind of like yourself having an expired driver's license. You still know how to drive, but you just got to go take care of the paperwork.
But you wouldn't be driving. And in this case, you are providing you are providing engineering services. You're representing yourself as a professional engineer, providing consultation services to an administrative law judge, right?
Yes, which I am, but again, I'm not stamping anything. and it doesn't really matter. I've run into this before, like when I came back from Africa, it doesn't preclude you from having a judgment and an opinion. It just precludes you from stamping something. And you're welcome to talk to the board if you want, but that's just the way it is.
No, I'm just trying to understand your position on this and what the status is.
That's fine.
Are you doing any other engineering work right now?
Nothing that precludes a stamp right now. There's some things, I'm just doing some odd things on the site. We're building some cabins right now. I'm really concentrating on building my house, and that's why I haven't went through the steps of updating my status of my license, because I really don't need the work right now. So I just, working on my house and doing some projects for some friends. So I'm taking it easy.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Albert. I don't have any other questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Sure.
Thank you. Mr. Denley, do you have any questions for this witness?
I do have a couple.
Okay, so Mr. Elbert, Mr. Denley represents Bighorn Logging. He's their attorney, so I'm going to let him ask questions of you. Go ahead, Mr. Denley.
Okay. Hello, Mr. Elbert, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Let me know if for whatever reason you're not able to. So, did you sign any kind of a retainer agreement with Mr. Kroll?
No, it's more of a verbal. We've known each other a long time, and So,
when did you retire from engineering?
I'm not really retired. I'm just kind of in limbo right now. Cause like I said, I'm taking time to build my house.
Okay, but you don't have an active engineering practice at present, correct?
No, I let that go because I wanted to build my house. I didn't want to have to pay all the fees and insurance and everything else that goes with it. And once I get my house done, then I'll reinstate all that stuff.
It looks like the last time that you were licensed, your expiration date was 12/31/2019. Does that seem about right?
2019, yeah, that's about right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then since that time, you haven't been able to, I guess what you described as stamp any kind of report or anything like that as an engineer?
No, I haven't had to, no.
And when you were in Water Resources before, did you have your own shop or did you work for someone else?
I worked for Pacific Water Resources. I worked for OTAC. And then I had my own design build company, Watershed Works. And I like to get in the field and survey my own things and engineer my own things and often build them as well. And I've been contracted out with the federal highways or national parks when they have issues of designs in the field that aren't working, and they have personnel problems between different agencies like up in Olympic Peninsula. I just tend to get along with people, and I work really well in the field of thinking on my feet and seeing how things work. And that's where my real expertise is, and that is what I get called in for. And that's why George called me, because he knows that. And I'm really comfortable with where I am. It's, as far as the license being active or not, it doesn't preclude my knowledge. It's just I just need to get around to it, but I haven't had a reason to do it, so...
You can hammer on that,
but that's what it comes down to.
You mind if I move on just for a bit?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Do you hold yourself out as an expert in the Forest Practices Act?
Not in the Forest Practices Act, no. So I haven't had to deal with that in particular.
Right, and that means that you really haven't gone through in any kind of detail either the statute or the administrative rules that deal with the Forest Practices Act. Do you agree with that?
I have not gone through that, no.
Okay. And do you hold yourself out as an expert in reforestation?
In reforestation? I've done it, but I wouldn't consider myself an expert in reforestation. That's right. Not my field.
Okay. So, I mean, you planted trees. I understand that. But, yeah. I mean, do you have a professional engineering degree or similar licensure in the area of reforestation?
No, I don't. But honestly, I don't see what it has to do with this case.
Okay. And then do you hold yourself out as an expert in the area of retention of vegetation or vegetation retention along streams, consistent with the Forest Practices Act?
Except for that last phrase, I'd say yes. I don't know the Forest Practices Act, but as far as riparian vegetation and bioengineering on streams and landslides to prevent that kind of things that happen to streams and so forth, yes, I am.
And would you agree with me that depending upon whether you're in Washington or Oregon or Idaho or whatever state, each state has kind of their own particular rules and regulations relative to the retention of vegetation along streams?
They probably do, but there's an awful lot of overlap. When you work in the public sector, you begin to realize that other agencies just borrow from other agencies, and they don't always make the best sense. But I imagine there's not much difference. There's probably some caveats because they have to agree with certain local laws and what have you.
Right. Okay.
It doesn't really change your analysis much.
Well, it would change your analysis, however, depending upon what the rules of that specific locality require, correct?
Well, there could be some of that, but what I'm trying to say is that the analysis you're doing is really... There's only a certain amount of analysis you can do, and those are kind of baked into everything, and it really comes down, in the end, to judgment on certain issues. But you do have to, if they have some kind of rule or some kind of special thing, then you may have to go through another hoop. But, you know, I mean, you could design in Idaho, Montana, Washington, wherever, with the exception of Alaska because of freeze thaw, and you can pretty much be designing the same thing, but you just have to adapt to the rules.
Right. So judgment in that situation would have to be adapted to the rules relevant to that area. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that your judgment's going to change as far as your opinion on something. I mean, if you're being honest. But if you have to formulate it or phrase it a different way, then yeah, you have to, you know, put it a different way to get the same point across you would in another jurisdiction.
Consistent with the rules that being applied in the situation, correct?
Sure, if there is consistency in the rules, I'd run an awful lot where there isn't.
Well, is it your take that the rules in this case are simply wrong, Mr. Elbert?
I have not studied them in depth, so I couldn't have an opinion on that. But my experience with other rules, especially when it comes to streams and forestation and stuff like this, the experience that I've had is that there's a lot of gray areas there. And I think a lot of things that need to be tightened up and loosened up. So, you know, as you know, rules aren't perfect. They don't apply to everything. But I guess that's another conversation.
In this situation, Mr. Albert, did you generate a written report?
What's that? Sorry?
Did you generate a written report?
No. I don't have the resources to do that. And I wasn't asked to do that either.
Right. So the testimony that you provided today is essentially by memory?
You broke up there. I'm sorry.
The testimony that you provided today was essentially by memory.
By memory.
What you recall?
No, I don't know where you're going with that. I mean, as far as memory in the field, sure. But everything else I'm testifying about is the matter of experience and seeing what was out in the field. It's just like that. Mm-hmm.
So you were out there for 2 to 3 hours on a single day, correct?
Oh, as far as being in the field, yeah, I was only there for 3 hours, probably, something like that, if that.
And what day were you there?
couldn't tell you. I don't know, a couple months ago or something. I'm sure there's a record of it somewhere.
And I take it that based upon the questions that Mr. Krall provided to you, the real focus of your testimony as elicited by Mr. Krall were really kind of on the upper reaches of that northern unit. Would that be accurate?
Can you restate that, please? I didn't quite get what you're trying to say.
You were talking about certain kinds of things with Mr. Krall. It sounds like you were talking about areas that were further up into the sale as opposed to in other areas of the basin.
No, we didn't really touch much on the upper areas of the sale. It's more about, we did talk about that, but my focus is really about the safety of the house and the water system. And the very first cut was the nearest cut of the downstream on that a lot of land to be cut. And it's unfortunate that happened because I think, it would have worked out all right. But so that was my focus, was the downstream portion. But realizing that the upstream portion does have an effect on the downstream, but it's just that immediate area there that's really concerning to me. And the safety of the house.
Mr. Krall, or Mr. Helper, is there a risk if you leave the trees, is there a risk to the house if you leave the trees in that riparian area?
Yeah. Sorry, can you restate that, please?
Sure.
My phone keeps breaking up. Yeah.
That's fine. Is there is there a risk to the house if you leave the trees that have been felled in that riparian area?
Sure, there's a risk there as well. There's also a risk of taking the trees out, and because you just lost some more potential biomass to basically plug up the stream.
So what I hear you saying is, if you leave the trees in, there's a risk. If you take the trees out, there's a risk.
Yeah.
And the judgment call that you have to make is to decide, based upon the rules, whether you should leave the trees or take out the trees, correct?
A rule, did you say?
The rules, the Forest Practices Act.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't really have an opinion on that because I don't know the rule to that degree. What I'm trying to say is that no matter what you do, there's risk there, but I think there's a better chance of leaving at least some of the timber there that it's going to put biomass or get tangled up basically and start protecting that stream bed from flowing back downstream with debris flows. Now, I don't really say it in an elegant way, but that's kind of how it comes together.
That sounds like an issue of reforestation. Would you agree with that? And how to repair, if you will, the stream area?
Yeah, you can certainly repair it. Reforestation is one way. But again, having that base biomass there is better than just clearing it all out in that particular spot. It's just for that. It's too bad they cut it right there, but just because of the location of that and the proximity to the house and the water system. And so, having that there and reforesting is a great thing. I think that would be the ultimate way to go with this, but it doesn't mean necessarily that that's gonna happen. But and not to preclude that there could be another way of going about it as well.
Is there a danger, Mr. Elbert, in your experience, that if you leave the trees in there, there can be kind of this retention, almost like a beaver dam effect of water piling up behind trees or tree vegetation and then bursting out?
There's always a chance of that. And even with the trees that are downstream, which would be to the, because of these east, on the other side of the stream of the house. you're going up through that ravine, there's a lot of evergreens in there. And if you go further upstream, you start getting into alders and stuff where current landslides were. So any of those in there can be potential for backing up and bursting out. And it's really no different than if the logs that are cut there were left, you can still have potential with that as well. So I just think having a few of those in there makes good sense in the sense of being able to cause more of a beaver dam, but it's actually stronger, and you get sediment behind that changes the specific energy of the stream because it's flatter. That means it has less energy, and that more soil and stuff that does come downstream will tend to settle out there because it is slower, and you'll have less mass energy to have debris flow happen. So what I'm getting at is I think it's important to leave at least a few of those in there, and you know, take whatever else there is, I guess. But yeah.
So do you have all the exhibits that we have?
I'm not really sure. I know I had the 2014 LIDAR and a bunch of other things. I haven't read through all them. I've been out of reach for quite a while and just kind of got those suddenly, so I haven't got a chance to go through every particular one of them.
Sounds good.
All the emails.
Thank you for your time. For your time.
You bet. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Krall, anything else for your witness?
Yeah. Yes, please.
Go ahead.
So, Mr. Elder, are you recommending any specific treatments or plans for Spring Branch?
You say plants or plans?
Plans, no T, plans.
No T, oh, okay. Well, you know, the sorry thing is that very common piece that.
Let me be more clear. Am I asking you to stamp any plans?
Okay, witness would be able to answer the question.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Everybody, hold on. Mr. Denley, okay. Mr. Denley, I didn't hear what you said.
Mr. Krall is interrupting the witness. He asked him a question, and Mr. Albert has not responded as
yet. Okay. So, Mr. Albert, why don't you go ahead and respond? Mr. Krall, if you feel like the answer isn't responsive, you can rephrase, okay?
Thank you.
Okay. Maybe rephrase it, because I didn't quite get what you were trying to say.
I'm sorry for being unclear. Have I asked you to develop any specific plans for Spring Branch?
No, you have not.
If I were to ask you to do such a thing, what would you need to know in order to develop a specific plan for Spring Branch?
Well, I'd have to get out in the field more, and the other is that I'd take another closer look at Mr. Vernon's geotech report. Yeah, it depends how much detail there is, but one thing for certainly is I'd have to get my license activated so I could, you know, do the plan.
Right. But you know what you would need to know in order to develop a plan you could put a stamp on.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And that's right.
I don't have any further questions right now. Thank you, Mr. Albert.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Gray, I don't think I asked you any questions for this witness. Okay, thank you. Mr. DeVore, anything else for this witness?
No, 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 thank you.
Okay, Mr. Denley, anything else?
No, ma'am.
Okay. Mr. Obert, thank you so much for your testimony and your time today. You can go ahead and disconnect and get to your ferry. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Judge.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Ken Albert
has left the meeting.
Okay, great. So we're at 12:13. I think we should take a lunch break here. When we come back, it looks like from my notes, we are going to take the testimony of Mr. Baldwin, and then Mr. Krall will also take your testimony. And then I want to try, hopefully we can get in closing arguments as well today. I think it's going to be kind of a long afternoon, but hopefully we can get through all of this. I propose a 30-minute lunch today, just so we have a little extra time when we come back. Is there anybody that needs more than 30 minutes? If so, speak up. Okay. I'm not hearing anything. So we're at 12:13. Let's come back at 12:45 from lunch. You can disconnect from the hearing, or you can leave the hearing going, and just make sure you mute yourself, turn off any cameras so there's not background noise. And we'll reconvene at 12:45. Mr. DeVore, we'll start with Mr. Baldwin's testimony first, right after lunch. All right. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Enjoy your lunch. Meeting.